Good morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler. I'm your host today for Wednesday, KBOO's Wednesday Talk Radio Show. And today, our show, we'll be discussing missing and murdered Indigenous women. On May 5th, the city of Portland recently celebrated its second Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Day. And we have here today Deborah Maitubi Denton Shipman, who is the founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, which is based here in Portland, Oregon, and has been really active in getting the city and also addressing the issue locally. Deborah, are you here?
Yes, I am.
And actually, I should correct that. You're actually a national organization, and you work with families, MIW families from across the country, right?
Yes, we do. Yeah. We cover it all.
Yeah. So... And you have some good news to share as well. Could you talk a little bit about that?
House Bill 2625 that Shauna Sanchez submitted is now going to be a law. It's gotten through two unanimous votes with the Oregon State Judicial or Government. I don't know how to address that. This is my first time being involved with any kind of political or governmental law, so it's been a real experience. But it did pass unanimously, and it's going to be signed. I think it's on the 17th.
On the 17th of May.
Yes.
It's going to be signed into law by the governor?
Well, here, let me check on that just to make sure.
So, yeah, Oregon House Bill 2625 was introduced by Oregon Representative Tawna Sanchez from Portland. She is Native American herself, of Shoshone, Bannock, Ute, and Carrizo descent. And so the bill will attempt to address the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, and it will direct the Oregon State Police to study how to increase criminal justice resources for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls across the state, and will bring together a commission on Indian Services, local law enforcement agencies, Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes, and urban Native American organizations to identify barriers and create partnerships. One of the big issues facing this is a lack of data, a lack of information. Native women often are not identified as Native in the statistics, and then also there's not a lot of coordination that happens through law enforcement when they go missing, when Native women go missing. So it's getting folks to getting action for the families is really frustrating. Deborah, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
It's going to be signed at 4 p.m. May 16th.
Oh, May 16th. Great.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure hoping that, the study is going to, really reveal our obstacles that we have to overcome. It's just ridiculous. And if I can I... talk about a situation that we just had happen last week?
Sure. I should say that your group actually works directly with families and helping them find lost loved ones and work with law enforcement. And you've had a lot of success, actually. So go ahead and...
Yes, we have. We really have. And probably one of our biggest successes to date is the missing 6-year-old from North Dakota last week, and she was abducted. We had her on video being drugged to her car. It was obvious that there was a problem, but yet it took law enforcement 32 hours to figure out just whose jurisdiction she was in. And it ended up being the Yankton Sioux jurisdiction. And then, they never issued an Amber Alert. And it was a really frightening situation, and it went viral on social media. So we've got a lot of new people on our page that are just like horrified. But anyway, we were we found her in 3 days. It took 3 days to get a hold of her, and the people that reported her and had found her, they'd actually seen our ad for her, and so they were made aware, you know, that she was missing, and then they, you know, called it to law enforcement. But it was one of our best saves, but it was also one of our scariest.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
So you actually had video of this 7-year-old girl being forcibly taken, and it took how many hours again for law enforcement to decide whose jurisdiction it was?
It took 32 hours.
32 hours, and so much can happen in 32 hours. And
yeah, we've had in Montana, there's a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old that by that time, you know, they had found them murdered. And so that's what was ringing in the back of our head. It was just terrible.
Because jurisdiction is a big issue here, because, well, the Yankton Sioux tribe, that's my father's tribe, so I'm very familiar with that reservation and in South Dakota. And so you have the Yankton Sioux tribe, you have, which has jurisdiction over its tribal members and within the reservation, and then you have the county, I guess that'd be Charles Mix County in South Dakota, and then you have the federal jurisdiction of the FBI. And the tribes don't have the jurisdiction clearance to be able to just pursue these cases, because they often don't have jurisdiction over non-natives, right?
Right. Right. It was that's one of the issues we hope that all these bills passing and Savannah's law addresses this need nationwide, but I'm not quite sure when that's going to take effect.
Yeah, that bill was blocked last year by a Republican senator, and then so it's been reintroduced this year by Senator what is the senator's name from Alaska? Murkowski, Senator Murkowski, and so we'll see how it does this year in Congress. But there are some, there is also the Violence Against Women's Act, which is still being held up, the reauthorization of it. And what held it up last time in 2015 was, of course, the extension of jurisdictional powers to tribes over non-native people, perps, I guess. But that was very limited. You basically have to be in some kind of long-standing relationship with the person. So it doesn't actually apply to traffickers, does it? I mean, you're not in a long-standing relationship with your trafficker, and it doesn't apply to children either, because children, of course, don't have those kinds of relationships, romantic relationships. So there's huge gaps still in the ability of, and only a few tribes, maybe 40 tribes have qualified under that?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure on that one, Jackie.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I think it's, there's a lot of bills going on. I'm really glad to see that the Oregon House Bill 2625 will be signed by the governor. And you say May 16th? And,
yeah.
This is just a start, though, isn't it? It's just beginning to sort of investigate what the problem is. And I attended the hearing, actually, with you in Salem last week, and it appears that there's also no funding with the bill either.
Yes, and that, unfortunately, they think that's one of the things that made it unanimous. But, I just hope that moving forward, I mean, I in my heart, I think that we could do it for very little funding, but it's going to take you know, the coordination of, you know, us, the tribes, the state police, you know, it would have to take a lot of coordination, but I think this means enough to the Native people of Oregon to, you know, get this thing going. And I think people would step up. I don't know if that's something that, you know, government's done much, is search for the people that can do this for very little funding. I mean, I know that us as an organization, we would donate that time, mm-hmm. you know, and because it does, it just means so much. And when you were at the hearing, you got to see my dear friend Carolyn DeFord talk about her mother, who's been missing for 18 years in Eastern Oregon by LaGrande. And I mean, no one is taking responsibility for that, not one law enforcement. And I do believe that from the first hearing, that state representative did get onto the police in that area, and they did find a body there a week before last, but they haven't let us know who that is. And we were hoping, you know, for closure in Carolyn's case, but a lot of things didn't match up, and it's not her mother, but it's someone's child, you know, and we like to hurry up and find out who's.
Yeah, her testimony was really quite moving. I was really, you know, here she's been, her mother's been missing for 18 years. They, once again, you know, families don't get, when they report their loved ones missing, I actually found it really moving what a one of the a young woman who testified there from the Yakima Nation. She was saying how she's afraid to go to the bathroom at like a public place, like a grocery store or gas station, because she's afraid she won't come back because it happens so often. And yeah. And that if she was reported missing, she's 17 years old and very active in her community, and that basically the police would say, well, you know, that's what Indian women do. They just disappear. They just go off, and it wouldn't be investigated.
They always, you know, not always, but like 99% of the time, you know, they'll brush it off saying the person was on drugs or drinking or a prostitute. Well, even, and that's just not true, but even if it was true, that person still is a human being, you know? And not, murder shouldn't be just swept under the rug. That's the thing, you know? And especially with Yakima, it is, at this particular time, it's the worst reservation in the United States for this. And, you know, I've seen that when we first started, we started out as a simple page on Facebook. And Yakima, we had so many people writing in, begging for help, and they were afraid to tell the local police their feelings because they know they're not protected. You know, so that particular issue of safety is a huge, huge thing on reservation. And when you find one such as Yakima, I mean, this is like I usually say, you know, our normal and their normal is other people's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, this is just awful what's happening.
Well, I know, you know, we had that, I got the opportunity to moderate a panel on missing Indigenous women at Portland Center Stage in late April with yourself and with also Lissa Lynn Loring, who is the cousin of Ashley Heavy Runner Loring, who has been missing in Montana, and also with Emily Washines, who is a Yakima historian, who's been doing a lot of work in on this issue on her reservation. And she was saying that the official FBI statistics say there only have 16 cases. But she and she's actually been working with the Yakima Herald, the reporter Tammy Ayers. You should definitely look up her reporting. It's just amazing. The Yakima Herald is a non-native paper from the city of Yakima, but they have done some amazing work and have a whole page devoted to this issue. I think one of the only papers in the country that does. And they've been really working with tribal members to bring out their stories. And they've accounted for over 40 now. And so the numbers are much higher. And you know, the reasons, the study that came out in November from the Seattle Urban Indian Health Health Board definitely has some pretty scary numbers, and certainly for Washington State. Some of the numbers that they have in their report is that 84%, that's how many Indigenous women have experienced physical, sexual, or psychological violence in their lifetimes, according to the National Institute of Justice. 1 in 3, that's how many Native American women have been raped or experienced an attempted rape, according to the Justice Department, more than twice the national average. 13%, that's how many sexual assaults reported by Native American women result in arrest, according to the Justice Department, compared with 35% for Black women and 32% for white women. 506, the number of Indigenous women and girls who have disappeared or been killed in 71 urban cities in 2016, according to the November report by the Urban Health Institute. 116 cases, this is in 2016, 5,712 Indigenous women and girls were reported missing, but only 116 were logged by the U.S. Department of Justice's Federal Missing Persons Database, according to the National Crime Information Center. So those are some of the numbers that your group is facing. Could you tell me a little bit about what got you started on this work and a little bit about yourself, Deborah?
Well, how I started this whole journey was when I was a general manager for a cell phone company in Southern Oregon, and I'd been in that industry for about 19 years. And when we got sold to Verizon, and when they only offered two of us jobs, it's like we both did turn them down, you know. And what I decided to do was go back to school and serve my people. And so
what nation are you?
I'm Chickasaw Nation. I'm registered Chickasaw Nation, but I'm also Choctaw. A little bit more Chickasaw than Choctaw.
So you're enrolled in the Chickasaw tribe in Oklahoma, and also, but you're also of Choctaw descent.
Yeah. And anyway, so when I went back to school, we actually went down to Navajo Nation, you know, and just my ex-husband, that's what tribe he's from, and we went down there with intentions to just go to Dene College and come back.
So Dene College is the Navajo Nation's college there. Yes.
Yeah, it's a community college. It's like a 2-year college. And once we got down there, though, you know, it's like the things that we saw, you know, we stayed a lot longer than 2 years. We stayed down there almost 7 years. And he's got a lot of family down there, and they were in need of help. So, you know, that's what we did. And we were living in Gallup, and Gallup, New Mexico. And we hadn't been there but like 2 months, and then one of our friends got murdered. And then like 2 weeks after that, one of my girlfriends got murdered, Sharon Etzity. And then it was probably about four months later that my dear friend Andrea Begay was murdered. And, you know, the thing that struck me the most was when our first friend, Wallace Weaver, got murdered. And let me just add in here real quickly. We have a high rate, murder rate in our men and missing men, too. Not to the degree that we do the women, but we do have a lot of missing men. And anyway, so like...
Well, I should also mention that the violence against Native men is definitely indicated by the incredibly high level of death by police that Native men experience. Actually, 6 times that of Black men. And but of course, we don't know how good the statistics are, but it's definitely points to, you know, that Native men are much more vulnerable to being murdered by the police.
Yes, yes, they are. And I mean, we actually started out a branch, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Men. And, you know, it's like, because we only did the women for many years. And then once we started the page with our men, it actually made me feel really bad that we had waited so long, because the mere volume of people that's on that little page, they've all lost some, you know, a loved one who's a man, and that's been, you know, sort of pushed back. And it's definitely time to talk about them too. But when I was in Gallup, living in Gallup, one of our male friends went missing, and I was working trying to find them with an organization of missing in New Mexico, and I started volunteering for them. And our first family that came forward was a family of Amy Hansen, who had been murdered just like 6 months prior. And that was my first experience from the family side. And I have to tell you, it's just heartbreaking. And I still talk to her sister Christy every single day. And it's been 4 years now, and like the only kind of update that family gets is when they call in, and it's always they haven't it's an ongoing cold case, and they haven't. It's just, that was my first experience with the family, and then the jurisdictional stuff. And when I was at Dene College, you know, they prepare people to go right out and work in Indian country in the behavioral and social sciences. So I was aware of the jurisdictional nightmare, but to experience it was like a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
And we finally did come back to Oregon, and I started at Portland State, and it was there that the idea for an organization first took hold, you know, and just different things. And Judy
here in Portland, at Portland State University, you began organizing, began this national organization.
Right. Well, it was while I was going there that it was started, but they've been really supportive over the years, you know. And it was Judy Blue Horse Skelton, a teacher, Native Nations teacher there. She knew about my friends. It's like, so what she would do was when she assigned me things, she'd assign me things that would help me heal from my 2 murdered friends. And in the midst of that is when we started the page, and then 2 years after that, we actually became a national organization. So anybody that's thinking about branching out, you know, and doing Native issues and things like that, you know, I mean, if you do it and you get, you know, a good reputation built up like we have, then you know, it can become something bigger, you know. So don't ever hold back on your activism.
Definitely. So I'd like to, this is a call-in show, so I would like to encourage folks to call in. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We are on KBOO. And this morning we are talking to Deborah Maytubi Denton Shipman, the founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. It's a national organization addressing this issue and helping families. And it's based here in Portland, Oregon. You can call into the studio to participate in the discussion at 503-231-8187. And I definitely encourage folks to call in and ask Deborah your questions. And I really wanted to address the numbers to kind of give our audience a sense of how many people your organization helps. I know that we had that update you gave in April about the numbers you faced in the first quarter of this year. I can go through some of the numbers, or do you have them handy?
I don't.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll go ahead and read from your post, if that's okay. And
okay.
All right. So this is so Deborah's organization, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, has a Facebook page, MIW USA, and they also have a website as well, MMIWUSA.org. But here's an update of some of the cases that they've dealt with in the first quarter of this year. So we have officially passed the first quarter of 2019, and so they gave an update that was current as of April 5th, 2019. So in the month of January, we included women and girls who went missing at the end of December 2018 as well. In this time period, we recorded 36 women who went missing. 23 of them were found safe, which made the recovery rate about 63%. In January, there were 3 murders, none of which have been solved. Brittany Madplume was found deceased outside of her boyfriend's home, and her death was listed as caused by intoxication, even though she was found beaten. No investigation into how she ended up that way has been done, and she has gone without justice. Amber Hopkins went missing in January and was just recently found deceased outside of a vacant home. The investigation into her murder is currently underway. Roxy Fazy of Broken Bow, Oklahoma, was also recently found deceased and having been missing since January. She was murdered and no suspects have been identified, although Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation is looking for her killer. The most common age for girls to go missing was about 16 years old. In this month, a few kidnappings occurred and trafficking was considered a high risk. The worst states for missing persons during this month were Montana and Oklahoma, and Montana has remained the number one worst state for missing persons for the entirety of this year. Girls who we want to draw attention to are, is it okay if I say their names on air?
Yes. Actually, you know what? Actually, Jackie, the minors is probably better.
Okay. All right. So I'll go ahead and, but you can see this post on her Facebook page. And so in February, not quite so many girls went missing. Over 26 disappeared, with 19 of them being brought home to safety. This made our recovery rate about 73%, which is the highest of this year so far. During this month, our worst states were Montana, Oregon, and Idaho. Thanks. There was an unexpected surge in disappearances in Oregon, which was unexpected. But thankfully, all women recovered safely, and this did not continue into the next month. Despite this good news, during this month, 16-year-old Tomica Yellowhorse of the Navajo Nation was found murdered in Albuquerque after leaving home one night. Her family is devastated, and no updates on the status of the investigation into her murder are available. This is another death which may likely go without anyone being held accountable. We continue to push for Tomica's justice. Our hearts go out to her family as they continue to mourn her death. Have there been any updates in that case?
No, she still hasn't been found.
Wow. March has been a terribly painful month. As of current, only half of the 41 women and girls who have gone missing have been returned home. Our worst states this month were Montana, Nebraska, and Minnesota, and we are seeing record highs for the year in these states. Several who went missing will not be returning to their families as they have walked on. Andine Jones, 3 years old, of the Navajo Nation, was found deceased after about 2 weeks of being missing. We send our condolences to her family and the Navajo Nation as they mourn the loss of this little child. Tambi Laframboise of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe was found murdered in a brutal way by her partner after disappearing from Yankton, South Dakota. Diana Keel of Nashville, North Carolina, was found murdered by her husband. Elder Margie Childers of the Creek Nation was found murdered in Okmulgee, and her husband was arrested in relation to her murder. Martha Thigh was brutally murdered by her partner towards the end of this month. Native women experience domestic violence at a rate almost 10 times the national average, and homicide is one of the leading causes of death for young Native women, according to the CDC. We send our condolences to all the tribes and families affected by the deaths of these women, which came far too soon. We also ask that you would send out prayers to the family of Jessica Alva, who was beaten by her partner and is currently fighting for her life in a hospital in California. I think that she's deceased.
She passed away that weekend, and that was the, well, I would say, I was going to say that's the worst, but it's not. It's just common that, like, they, the San Francisco police actually let a man who's suspected of her murder stay in the same apartment overnight. And
where she was murdered, which was a crime scene, right?
Yeah, which was a crime scene. And they had, there's been a man step forward to say he was called to clean that. And, you know, the police had ended their investigation, so the apartment was clean. And we had kind of pushed for them to use luminol because that'll still work. But you can't, you know, you can't use, it has to be the police's evidence that you use. You can't have somebody like luminol the apartment and then, you know, that testimony stand up in court.
So let me make this clear for our audience. So a woman, Jessica was murdered, right? And the suspected murderer was allowed to stay overnight in the apartment where she was murdered, an active crime scene. And then he hired someone to come and clean the place and to erase any evidence. And now the police have they closed the case, or is it still open and they're not actively trying to
they haven't completely closed it, but they also haven't arrested the husband, but he is in jail for a parole violation. He just had got out of prison. It was a drug crime, so it was a nonviolent crime. So they, you know, it's like that case just made me see, even if you have a warrant out for your arrest for you know, not fulfilling your parole, well, you know, they don't really push to find the perpetrator at all. And but he is right now in Shasta County Jail. And they believe, like, from what her mother says, they're going to send him back to prison.
Wow.
For the violation.
And the mother, her mother actually posted some pretty pretty graphic photos of her daughter on social media, right?
Yes, and it went viral, like, on Instagram and on Facebook. So, you know, it's like the same with our little girl that was found last week. You know, those cases are making the outside world particularly aware of what we're facing. And we've got a lot of new Anglo people on our page, and they're horrified.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's yeah, I think you know, you're talking about how when you first were at Dene College on the Navajo Nation and you began to to see how frequent this is. And I should mention that I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation, and we are the largest Native federally recognized tribe in the United States, with over 360,000 enrolled members, citizens, and you know, most, a very large number speak Navajo, well over 100,000 are fluent, and you know, we're, I often say this, you know, that we're the Navajo Nation. The land base is about the size of Ireland. It has the population of Iceland. It's larger than 22 member states of the UN. It's a country within the United States, and this is the largest generation of Navajos, I think, ever. I mean, I think over 70% of the population is under the age of 27, so it's a very young population. And I remember when I was working on the Navajo Nation, when I first got to college, I got to work as a community organizer in Eastern Navajo. And I remember that Chinle, which is one of the larger towns on the reservation, they had recently changed their elementary school into a kindergarten school. Like, the entire elementary school was transformed into a kindergarten school because there were so many young people coming up, you know. It's funny because I just wrote an article for Bitterroot Magazine about missing and murdered Indigenous women, and I opened it actually with the fact that when I was, you know, I published that book a couple of years ago about Bear's Ears, and I did a book tour through Utah and Arizona, and I was just amazed at the energy of a lot of the Navajos coming up. I mean, they're really active in politics. They're pushing back, you know, at the white dominant power structure. You know, I have like a cousin who ran for Congress in Utah this past midterms, you know, and there's just so much energy in that generation, so much positivity, and they're just so willing to go out there and change things. You know, and yet at the same time, I began to see that so many of them were the victims of violence.
Yeah.
And I actually one of the people I met when I was down there was Moroni Banale, and he's a Stanford graduate working on his doctorate, and he's really active in kind of organizing the Native vote. He's gay. He's openly gay in Utah, and I guess I don't know if he's still an active Mormon, but he also ran for the Navajo Nation president. There was a documentary that came out on PBS in the fall about his run for Navajo Nation president, and you know, he was supposed to moderate a panel for us about the book. And the night before, he got beaten up. He was targeted for being gay and for being Native. And I saw him afterwards, and just to see this incredibly intelligent, brilliant man being brutalized. I mean, and it wasn't, you know, and you know, it wasn't just him, you know, it was, you know, other folks I was meeting. There was a young woman, Cassandra Begay, who was, I don't know if you saw that video went viral of her confronting Zinke, former Secretary of Interior Zinke, about, you know, him not talking to the tribes about Bear's Ears, right? And he bends down and shakes his finger in her face and says, "You be good." You know, and it was an incredibly condescending way, and she challenged him, and then I found out that, you know, her own aunt was murdered violently, you know, just recently, a few years back, and then another Navajo woman I met who was running for state legislature in Utah, you know, her mother had just been murdered in southern Utah, and it's just, you know, the pain it causes these families, and these are incredibly energetic, educated young Navajo people, and they're being, you know, this violence, they're still being actively targeted with violence, and I say targeted now instead of vulnerable, because I saw, actually, Moroni Banale posted a photo of himself holding a sign on Instagram saying Indigenous people are not vulnerable, they are targeted, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important kind of point to make.
Yes, I do too, because this is not just, you know, people going out randomly and doing this. This is people who, like, seek out others to inflict damage on, you know, inflict violence on, and So no, that's like it. That's the way it should be said, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, because that's for sure. And I think it was there was a few people that spoke last week at the old church gathering that talked about, you know, having recordings of people planning, you know, actually planning to traffic native people for various reasons, you know. But no, that's good. I don't want to change it off the Navajo stuff, change the subject.
No, it's fine. Yeah, I would like to encourage people to call in again. It's been pretty quiet out there. Feel free to call into the studio. We're here on KBOO FM talking to Deborah Maytubi Denton Shipman, and she is the founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, based here in Portland, Oregon, and she's been telling us about her work with families, numerous families across the country, to bring Native women home, Native women and men home, and also to the good news that it looks like the governor will be signing a new Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women law here in Oregon. And it's Oregon House Bill 2625, and which directs the state police to study how to increase criminal justice resources for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And so, yeah, that's been a thing. How can some of our listeners help, either with your work or just in general?
Well, you know, I know this is a minor act, but like, come to our page, which is Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, and share those posts. You know, try to educate people and tell people. You know, if everybody tells two people what's going on, you know, that just grows and grows and grows. And then also, you can contribute donations, and we have a GoFundMe on that's posted at the top on our page, or you can hit the button on top, and it goes to mmiwusa@gmail.com, and that is a PayPal account. So you can do that. And then also, you know, something we need here locally is donations of a fabric, ribbon, and things like that, because we have a program called Staying Sacred for girls aged 10 to 18, and we actually do ribbon skirts for our elders and themselves. That's like an ongoing thing that we have going. And but yeah, things like that can really go a long ways. And we're just really grateful for all the public support we have gotten, you know, and because it's helped us grow. And you know, it's like we need organizations like this, you know, in order to help these families, because we help them, you know, of course, by counseling them, and I might insert in there all the people that do talk to these families and things. We have trauma informed care, and also you know, it's like all of the board members and myself have a lot of education that we can you know, we can throw into counseling people. And okay, now I forgot where I was.
Yeah. So with the, I wanted you maybe to talk a little bit more about the Staying Sacred program, exactly what it's about and what you what you hope to, how you hope to help younger Native women, girls?
Yeah, I think, you know, staying sacred is my answer to chronic depression. It's like actually a preventative program, and it's for girls age 10 to 18, and we just hit our sixth meeting. We meet the last Saturday of every month, and out at Tryon Life Farms. And so that, so anybody that's been out there will see that, just how beautiful location it is, so close to the city. But so we meet, like I said, the last Saturday of every month, and the meetings, how they go on for a while, because we get in there and start talking and start having activities, and you know, we just go with the flow. And anyway, like I think one of the most important things we do is that at every meeting they have a full hour to hour and a half of self-defense. And that's what...
Did you say self-defense?
Yep.
Self-defense.
So they're in it. They, it's a martial art, but the name is escaping me. But they... We have volunteers... that are just wonderful, you know, at teaching these girls, and these girls are totally involved. They're, you know, they just throw themselves into the activities that we do. But at every meeting we hit on a very hard topic to discuss. And we tell them everything about it. And by a hard topic, I mean stuff, you know, that is going to drain them emotionally. But it's like things that we need to, you know, address, like trafficking. Mm-hmm. We do trust, we touch on trafficking at every single meeting, but we also reteach that unit, you know.
Well, you know, you mentioned that in your report, that the majority of missing persons that you're dealing with are teens between the ages of 14 and 17. And Portland is itself on I-5, which is a trafficking route. Is that right?
Yes. And then plus, you know, not only do we have Interstate 5, but we have an international airport. We have the Port of Portland. We have international airport. I think I already said that, but and Amtrak. There's like five or six ways to get them out once they've got them, and a lot of people, places, you know, probably, you know, do that.
And this ties to also, you know, the incredibly high rate in which Native children are put in foster care. Children in foster care certainly have a much higher rate of being attracting predators.
Yes, absolutely. And we're studying that a lot more. I don't want to like go into it yet before, you know, we're not ready to do a report yet on it, but like, It you know, foster care is a huge, it seems like there's a huge relation to that, you know, and trafficking. And the Indian Child Welfare in the state of Oregon has had us come out and do a teaching on MMIW and, you know, in particular, the trafficking that we're seeing. I mean, we have 11 children that are missing from Montana in April. So, you know, and they haven't been found. That is in Montana. One state.
Oh, we have one caller on the phone. Kay?
Oh, yes.
Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
First, I just want to thank you for your work and for this show around the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. I've been, you know, keeping track in my own way of and looking for ways to become involved to support as well. So I heard you ask for donations of fabric and craft things, and I was wondering where a person could bring that.
Well, you can actually bring them to Tryon Life Farm, and that's at 11640.
Yeah, Southwest. I've been out there.
Oh, okay.
I've been out there. I've volunteered.
Okay, or you can drop them off to Matthew at Portland State in the Native American Center.
Okay. That sounds great, and thank you very much again, and I hope to meet you at some point. And all the best to you too, Jacqueline. We've communicated a little here and there, and I still have those prints, and I would actually be interested to see if missing and murdered Indigenous women might be able to use some prints to fundraise with.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah. So, again, I'll probably come out to the farm this month and okay. The last Saturday in May. Thanks so much for that invite. Appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Hey, on those prints, we are going to be having the date hasn't been set yet, but we're going to be having a fundraiser for Ashley Loring Heavy Runner's family. They've been doing, like, They've done over 100 searches for their sister, and like a lot of times they were doing it with no food. And we don't want that happening this year. And so there's two of them, her family, that live here in Portland. So we want to do fundraisers here, help them out so they don't have to be hungry while they're looking for their sister. That just shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I was really struck by the Kimberly Loring, who is a sister of Ashley Heavy Runner Loring, gave testimony before Congress in December on missing Indigenous women, and she mentioned that they'd done over 100 searches. I think law enforcement had only done 7, and they'd actually been chased by bears, grizzly bears, while they were out there in Montana doing the searches. And she mentioned that that if it had been a poaching, they were poaching deer, that the police would have taken it much more seriously than her sister going missing.
And, yeah, and see, they didn't even bring anybody in to from, it's like they didn't really get any action till about 9 months after Ashley was missing, and that's when they did the searches. Not the family I'm talking about. The BIA actually took the case, but that, unfortunately, that is the way it happens. And we had 10-year-old Henny Strong from Montana that also, they didn't start looking for her till a week later. And she was deceased, and you could tell she had been hurt, you know, she had bruises and things on. But the coroner said that she died from exposure.
Wow. I should note the coroner is an elected position and may have no experience in actual medical examinations. And thank you so much for being on, Deborah. We're kind of coming up the end of the hour. And if you want more information about Deborah's organization, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA, you can go to their website, MMIWUSA.org, or to their Facebook page, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. And I think I'm going to kind of bring the point home about the lack of action, the inaction that families face when trying to find their loved ones. I'm going to read a little bit from an article I wrote for High Country News about the search for Olivia Lombear, which I titled No Crime Scene. So I'm just going to read the first few parts. 13 minutes into Taylor Sheridan's feature film, Wind River, the body of a young Native woman from the Wind River Reservation, Wyoming, is discovered by the protagonist, a white hunter who works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. That spurs a multi-agency investigation, and within days, officers from the Federal Bureau of Investigation and local and tribal law enforcement face off in a bloody Tarantino-style shootout with the bad guys, oil workers living in the company-owned temporary housing known as man camps. According to Sheridan, the film is, quote, inspired by true events and the thousands of actual stories just like it, involving the sexual assault of Native American women on reservations across the country. Yet Native families seldom get such dramatic closure or swift justice. Rarely do local or federal law enforcement officers respond so quickly or take bullets in defense of tribal members. Had Sheridan really wanted to be true to life, he would have ended his film with the family never finding the body of their loved one, much less tracking down the culprit. On October 24, 2017, a real Native American woman, a 33-year-old mother of four named Olivia Lone Bear, disappeared from the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. Her family has been frantically searching for her ever since. Like so many, and she was found in July, deceased. Like so many others, they've run up against uncooperative law enforcement agencies, which are themselves stymied by jurisdictional complications and a lack of resources. Tribal police told us they couldn't investigate Olivia's disappearance because there was no crime scene, her cousin Matthew Lone Bear told me in February, shortly after the Bureau of Investigation took over. The Bureau of Indian Affairs took over the investigation from the three affiliated tribes police. And so I think you're familiar with that case as well, aren't you, Deborah?
Oh, yes. I'm like friends with Matthew, and there's a lot of things I'd like to say about that, but, you know, I'm not going to get into that on here.
But you're familiar with the lack of inaction, the inaction on these cases, and how frustrating it is to families to see nothing being done for their loved ones.
And they had asked for that like the drug in the very beginning, you know, is the thing. And then that's where they end up finding her. So it's just
the lake there. Well, I think I talked to Matthew and he said that lake, that area of the lake had actually been searched three times. And,
Well, thanks for having us on, Jackie.
Thank you, Deborah, for all your work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And thank you for yours. I'll talk to you all later, and thanks for tuning in.
Thank you. And this is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am the host today for Wednesday Talk Radio. And I would like to thank you all. And you can definitely see more links and things on our webpage to the work of Missing Murdered Indigenous Women USA and Deborah Denton, Deborah May to be Denton Shipman. And thank you all.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:58. Coming up next at 9 o'clock, Radio Zine guest host Linda Olsen Osterlund looks at the May Day attack on Cider Riot patrons by Patriot Prayer, and she also takes your calls. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, The Dirt Bag takes a look at watering your garden and trying to grow apricots in Portland. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Ready for the intro?
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio this morning. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. This is the KBOO's Radio Zine. And this morning, what we're going to be talking about is the May Day attack by Patriot Prayer and Joy Gibson on Cider Riot, a brewery for cider and pub in inner southeast Portland. And so that's our topic, and I hope that you have heard about it at least some. It was on May Day itself. The May Day had gone on, and there had been a couple different kinds of demonstrations, and Patriot Prayer had come over and spent the day trying to bait people and get into fights, but did not. And they had also announced in advance they're going to Cider Riot. Cider Riot was having a party, an outside party, a celebration of May Day and International Workers' Day.